Hi, welcome to the MuckReads podcast. I'm Steve Engelberg, the managing editor of ProPublica. Recently, there have been a series of stories examining presidential candidate Mitt Romney and the financial firm he co-founded, Bain Capital. Various reporters have tried to determine when exactly Romney left the company, who exactly ran the company after he left, and why legal filings offer what appear to be conflicting explanations of when he left and how Bain grew during his tenure. Two reporters who have done an excellent job of piecing the puzzle together and answering those questions are Michael Cranish and Beth Healy of the Boston Globe. Cranish is the deputy chief of the Globe's Washington Bureau, and he's covered national politics, the White House, and Congress. Healy rejoined the paper's business section in 2008 to focus on financial investigations. In 2006, she was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for the series Debtor's Hell. They've written several reports about Bain and Romney, most recently focusing on the candidate's bargaining with the firm on a severance package after he left to run the Salt Lake City Olympics. Welcome to the podcast, Beth and Michael. And I think we want to start with the severance story. And maybe you could just give our listeners a brief summary of how you got started looking into the whole issue.
Well, sure. Beth and I worked on a chapter about Bain Capital in the Globe's biography of Mitt Romney, the real Romney, about a year ago. We started looking at the full career of Mitt Romney, 15 years at Bain Capital, examining close to 100 deals. So she and I have been researching and writing about Bain Capital and Mitt Romney, you know, for quite a long time. And in her work as a financial reporter, she'd also covered the business. So we really wanted to give a full look. And when the issue came up about when exactly he left and so forth, you know, that's why we wanted to plunge in to really look exactly at when he left, since questions have been raised. A prior Globe story by other reporters had clearly laid out that although there were statements by Romney that he left in 1999, that his work as a CEO and sole shareholder were listed in various filings up into 2002. So we picked up on that story.
Tell us why that's significant. I mean, it sounds in one sense a little bit arcane. You know, maybe he left and took a leave of absence. Maybe he was still there. Why is that so important?
Well, there have been stories about some deals that happened between 99 and 2002 and a little bit afterwards that involved some outsourcing companies. And so the Democrats have made a big deal out of Romney's involvement with that. And his pushback was that he was gone by the time those particular deals went into effect. Now, like I mentioned a minute ago, during the 15 years that no one questions that he was at Bain Capital, there were about 100 deals. Many of those are controversial deals. These particular deals afterwards involving some specific outsourcing questions, they had gotten a lot of publicity, and Romney was very strong in trying to push back, going on television networks saying no, he had left and so forth. So that's why it seemed worth a further look exactly, you know, what he was doing after 1999 at Bain Capital.
So how closely was he really involved in sort of these deals and the activities of Bain from 1999 to 2002? What does your reporting suggest about that?
What we found is that we don't believe that he was actually making deals in the normal way that partners do at a private equity fund during the period after February 1999. He was, however, still the CEO of the firm. He was legally still responsible for the firm and had many of the duties that a CEO does have, whether that meant signing documents, signing off on certain compensation-related issues, and certainly he probably was aware of a lot of the things that were going on at the firm, but he was not making the day-to-day investment decisions.
On some of these key things, though, about outsourcing, I mean, do you have a sense from your sources or interviews as to what his level of knowledge would have been? Is it something that, you know, kind of comes up after the fact? Is it something that he would have been aware of as part of the overall strategy? I mean, how directly connected is he?
Well, we interviewed, you know, for example, a professor who's an expert in these matters, and he pointed out in his view that if you're still a CEO, that you'd be aware of what's going on most likely, and that it seemed hard to this person to believe that you wouldn't, you know, be apprised, because during this period, one of the main parts of our story was that during this period between 99 and 2002, Mitt Romney was directly involved in negotiating a very profitable severance agreement. So when we say that, we're talking about a 10-year payout, basically, for part of the value of the firm. So during those negotiations, you're going to presumably know, according to this expert, how the company's doing, what's happening with certain deals and so forth, even if you're not coming in and saying, let's do this or not do that, you know, perhaps getting some information. So we reported that very specifically, and we've had, you know, by the way, you know, no pushback whatsoever from the Romney campaign on anything in our story.
Beth, as the business reporter in this team, take us a little bit inside a conversation like this. I mean, most of us, when we leave a job, a severance doesn't take 3 years to negotiate. Why was this so complicated?
Romney's, he actually started this firm. There was Bain Consulting, and they started this kind of spinoff that was Bain Capital to do the investments. And when he started it and started hiring a number of other partners to work with him, he was considered the sole owner and stockholder and CEO. Now, that doesn't mean he was actually making all the money from the firm. It was a partnership, and his partners would tell you that they all shared in the wealth that they accumulated from their investments. However, legally, because he was still the owner and the CEO, it meant there was all of this untangling to do to get his name off of all of these dozens and dozens of funds and offshore funds and various entities, including a hedge fund and a debt fund. And so there was some real complexity there to disentangling. But then in addition, when you create a firm like this that had become extremely valuable over that period of time, he has to sit there and say, okay, I'm going to leave and go to the Olympics, but you guys are all going to make a lot more money now, in part because I hired you all and got you all these jobs. And I want a piece of that action for, you know, out some period of time. So what he had to do is negotiate with them to say, you know, ultimately he won. Apparently he drove a pretty hard bargain and said, I think for 10 years I deserve a piece of the action.
Now, do we have a sense, I should know this, but do we have a sense from his disclosure documents what that piece of the action amounted to when all was said and done? What did all that add up to in terms of money? What did he get out of it?
I wish we knew.
I mean, the answer is, we don't know exactly. There are disclosure forms that come out when he files to run for office. There was when he ran for governor and then when he ran for president a couple of times. But those are fairly vague. They only come out at periodic times. They only give ranges of wealth. Because Mitt Romney has refused to release his tax returns for the relevant time period that we're talking about, in other words, 1984 when he began the firm, and then leading up into 1999 when he went on his leave of absence, and then there was a 10-year severance, which goes up to 2009. Well, the one-year tax returns that he's released so far is 2010, and he says he'll release 2011. So this is one of the main reasons that there would be a lot of public interest in seeing what is in the tax returns, because we really don't know an awful lot about the specifics of how much money he made, what is the tax rate that he may have paid, and Democrats have raised questions about whether he didn't effectively pay any taxes at all in certain years. We just don't know. I mean, the Globe for 18 years, I think, has been asking for his tax returns, not every year, but you know, when it's been relevant, he's running for office and so forth. So it's been an ongoing issue from the first time that Mitt Romney ran for public office. For example, in 1999, when he ran against Ted Kennedy for the U.S. Senate seat, he essentially said, if Kennedy, you know, are you hiding something? If you release your tax returns, I'll release mine. You know, sort of like two kids at a schoolyard. And Kennedy declined to release his. Romney declined to release his. And then when Romney ran for the governorship in 2002, his office didn't make a similar proposal. They basically said, we're not going to release these for privacy reasons. And that's around the time when you would have had a better idea, at least at the beginning, of what this, you know, very major 10-year deal would have been. So it's a long way of saying that because he's not released his tax returns, and we only have information basically from some periodic and imprecise financial disclosure reports, we don't know the answer.
It's fascinating. I hadn't really thought about this. But then so the year of taxes that they've released and the year they're promising to eventually release are outside that 10-year severance window.
That's right. And, you know, he still, you know, owns some things in Bain funds and so forth. That's different than a direct payment, you know, as part of the severance package. And severance is a word that is different in the context here. Here he's basically getting a major value of the firm he created. It's not like, you know, when a typical person leaves a job and may get a buyout. This was a difference. So severance in some ways is the wrong word, you know, because of the way most people think of severance. This was a large payout. By way of context, the financial disclosure reports that have been filed have indicated that at the time of those reports, his net worth may have been in the range of $250 million. The Boston Globe asked Mitt Romney several years ago that there were reports that his net worth might be as much as $1 billion, B as in boy, and he did not confirm or deny that. He just simply said he wasn't going to discuss it. So, you know, we don't know if his net worth, you know, was far more. That's the range we typically give. But again, that was when a certain report happened to have been filed, and certain amounts of money can be transferred to trusts, to your family, in all sorts of different ways. So because we don't have full documentation, we simply can't say, you know, what his net worth may have been at the max.
Well, there are a lot of mysteries here. I want to talk a little bit about, or ask you a little bit about, a more recent story of yours on Michael Milliken's involvement with Bain. Remind listeners, for those who've kind of forgotten the 80s or have tried to forget the 80s, who Michael Milliken was and why they might care today about ties between Milliken and Bain.
Sure. And this was a story that I also did with Beth, so she can talk about some of this as well. Michael Milken was basically known as the creator of the junk bond. This was a basically a vehicle in which you could use bonds to raise money for a company, but at pretty high interest rates with high risk. So they were called, quote, junk, and he really was known as the person who, you know, made this a part of the leverage buyout boom of the 1980s. And in the story, we describe Mitt Romney as transitioning from being a rather cautious investor. There's a famous story of Mitt Romney flapping his tie to mimic a heartbeat because he would get nervous about this deal or that deal. But there came a moment when, you know, there was a particular deal in a apparel chain that Mitt Romney and his partners wanted to invest in, and they needed financing. And Mitt Romney actually greatly admired what Michael Milken was doing at Drexel Burnham Lambert. So he went to the company and Milken for financing of, I think, Beth, correct me if I'm wrong in the numbers here, $300 million.
That's right.
And as they were getting this financing, it was very well known and widely reported that Drexel Burnham Lambert and Milken were under federal investigation for various things unrelated to this deal, to be clear. But there were other people who were dealing with Drexel at the time who basically walked away, didn't want anything to do with that. And Mitt Romney said, you know, he's innocent until proven guilty. And he, you know, they needed the money. And so he went through with the deal, despite the controversy. And we quote one of the persons who is very familiar with this deal in the story talking about how this was a turning point for Mitt Romney, that he was balancing out, you know, his caution with the idea that he could make a very large amount of money by doing this investment. So, you know, he referred to this in a later sort of obscure interview that we found in a banking magazine where he talked about this being, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but this being, you know, the glory days of Drexel Burnham Lambert. And obviously, you know, he's not endorsing what they did that then got them in trouble and so forth and eventually caused Milken to go to jail, but that was unrelated to this deal. But, you know, it was a very important deal. Let me let Beth pick up the next part of the story, which she reported on, as to then what happened with the deal.
Well, as Michael was describing, one of the amazing things about this was it showed Mitt Romney for the first time how little money Bain could put down of its own and its clients and leverage that with the debt. I think they put down about $5 million and ended up making like something like $120 million profit. So Mitt Romney really saw, despite his risk-averse ways, that this was an easier way to make money, for instance, than venture capital, you know, sort of fiddling with startups that might fail. Instead, they figured out a way with financial engineering to make a lot of money relatively easily. This firm ended up going bankrupt. It is still in business now, this apparel store. It's a chain of department stores, small department stores. So they are still in business now, but they did go bankrupt after Bain had gotten out of the company. And it's difficult to pin their problems precisely to Bain, but for sure they got deeply loaded up with debt and then struggled with that after Bain was out.
Right. And just to sort of translate for the sort of ordinary reader, what we're talking about here is you want to buy something and you yourself don't want to put the money on the table, so you could go to a bank, right? But the bank in this case is not going to loan you $300 million. So where does Drexel get the money? How does that? How do they raise it?
they raise money by getting investors who are willing to buy these bonds, and the investors demand a higher rate of return than, you know, say if they were getting T-bills or a CD. They want a higher rate of return, and they'll lend the money on these big deals.
So then you own a company, and it has a very high rate of debt and high interest payments. How does it work out then for the company? What happens to them?
So in the perfect world, what the private equity people will tell you is, as long as the company's doing well and bringing in a lot of revenue and is profitable, then they're able to pay off their bondholders, they're able to pay money to the shareholders if they have them, and everybody does well. But that's only in the perfect model. If things don't go so well, say the economy goes badly, say the business doesn't go so well, then the model really falls apart.
And in the history of Bain, there were hits and misses. So I presume in some cases where they did this, there were hits.
There were some big hits. We spent a lot of time on one. Domino's Pizza is probably one everybody's heard of. It has an extraordinary amount of debt on it, just like all these other deals. But for some reason or another, they're selling enough pizzas and it's working out.
Making it back one piece at a time, huh?
Yeah.
What's important about this is that I think for the average person, they probably see the ads from the Democrats and Republicans about Bain Capital, and each side, understandably, is going to put it in their own context. Either it was terrific or it was terrible. What we really tried to do, and this is more fully, you know, in the book the Globe produced, The Real Romney, which, as I mentioned earlier, Beth was a contributor to the Bain Capital chapter. We looked at, we got a hold of a prospectus, I think it was, that listed the majority of deals that Romney worked on during his time. And we basically went through methodically putting them in a spreadsheet and trying to determine which deal made money, how much money did it make, and so forth. And our conclusion was that the vast majority of the money that Romney and Bain made was on a relative handful of deals. They did make money on a number of deals, lost money on a number of deals. You know, these are deals that Bain Capital ran like a giant sort of mutual fund for very wealthy investors, if you will. Typically, an investor might put in $1 billion or more. And Romney's job was to make a good return on that investment. So in that part of the field, he was very successful, nearly doubling the investors' money year after year. If you look at Romney's own words, what he says was that he didn't go in there and run these companies. He left that to management. And that's Romney's own statement. You know, from my experience, a number of people you talk to don't necessarily realize that because the very general way it's talked about. Romney's job was as a investment fund manager, with some exceptions. He did go in and serve on some boards a few times, but for the most part, it was at a remove. For example, the deal that we discussed earlier with the department store chain that was financed by Drexel Burnham, one of the executives said he never met Mitt Romney. So it gives you a better idea that he's doing this at a remove. He's not going in personally and running those companies. You know, he may be providing some direction, but his main job is as, you know, approving or not approving deals, running the investment fund, and so forth. So there were some deals that didn't work out. Some deals were hugely profitable. Let me give you one example that we wrote about in the book that had not been written about before, as far as I could tell, except Romney's passing reference to it. And that's a deal where Bain put in $50 million into a company that was essentially an Italian phone directory company. And Romney was very nervous about this, eventually went along with it. Obviously, there's no U.S. subsidiary or jobs involved here, strictly an investment in an Italian company. Lo and behold, this company was riding the Internet boom. And the long story short is that this $50 million investment turned into a billion-dollar return, $1 billion, B as in boy. And one of Romney's partners told us that Romney himself may have made personally $30, $40 million on this one deal alone. So it gives you a better idea when you look at that about how Romney, you know, made a lot of money, not something where he went over to Italy and ran a company. It was a deal that, you know, yes, he did have to sign off on, turned out very, very well. As far as I can tell, it's probably the most profitable deal, or if not the most, one of the most profitable deals he was ever involved with.
So what is this if you're a voter and you're trying to sort of think through with all these negative ads and the rest of it? What does all this mean to the voter? I mean, what if anything, can one draw about, you know, someone's executive abilities or political leadership from their performance in this fairly specific field of investing? I mean, what you've been – obviously, the both of you have been studying this now for several years. What do you think voters can draw from this?
If, it's a complex question because it's not like his father, who went in, took over American Motors, turned it around. You know, that's a very clear line that you can draw. In this case, what is clear is that Mitt Romney basically created this company, and we describe in the book as sort of it was a no-risk proposition because of the backing from his mentor. But he created this company, Bain Capital, and it was and is an extraordinarily successful company for its investors. So when you look at it through that prism, there's no question that it's been an extraordinarily successful enterprise, and it made Mitt Romney a very, very wealthy person, and a lot of his investors very wealthy. When you then drill down, you know, obviously there are times when you invest, and there were times when factories were closed, there were times when factories were opened. You know, we try to go, you know, discuss some of these deals specifically about what happened to give you a better sense. Then it gets more complicated because there are cases where he might say, well, I wasn't directly involved, but he was overall, you know, the head of the company. So you sort of have to take the good with the bad. It's understandable that each side is going to try to spin it, you know, to their best advantage. I'll give you one example. You know, the Romney campaign has talked an awful lot about Staples. It's a store that probably, you know, most voters are familiar with. They may go there themselves. And in the case of Staples, he did put some initial money in. He put about $2.5 million into Staples when it was first starting out. And when they cashed out, he got back about $13 million. So that's a very successful rate of return, but very small when you compare it to the one I just told you about a minute ago with the Italian phone company where they put in 50 and got back a billion. So when you look at Staples in that context, you realize it actually was one of the smallest deals that Mitt Romney did. He does talk about Staples and say of the 100,000 jobs or more that were created in Romney's retelling of the story, that nearly 80,000 of those jobs he attributes to Staples. Most of those jobs did come after Bain pulled out its investment and cashed out from Staples. The Staples founder told us that it's fair for Mitt Romney to take credit for all the jobs ever created at Staples because without the initial backing, Staples might never have gotten off the ground. Critics would say, wait a second, most of those jobs came after you pulled out your investment. So it's a more complex picture. It takes me more than 30 seconds to explain it. So you can imagine how difficult it is for either side to explain it, you know, in the sound bites of their campaign or their campaign commercials. You can look at, you know, many, many deals and see each one is its own unique factor. The bottom line is that Mitt Romney did start out in the venture capital business, and that was the case with Staples and some other deals. But as Beth indicated earlier, he pretty soon transitioned to what became known as the field of leveraged buyouts, where by definition you're putting debt on the companies that you're buying, and there's more risk involved. Now, the field is now known as private equity. And that's essentially, if you talk to people in the field, a name they came up with because leveraged buyouts became so controversial. But that is, leveraged buyouts, you know, are specifically what Mitt Romney specialized in. So if you want to understand what Mitt Romney did in his business career, you really need to understand what leveraged buyouts are and what the impact of those kind of deals are, for better or for worse.
Now, both of you have studied his campaigns previously. Is the impression to at least this listener watching Romney for the first time on the national stage that he's not really talking very much about his business acumen in this campaign so far? Did he do that in Massachusetts, or was it more sort of in the fabric of what he was doing and trying to sell himself to voters?
I mean, I think he did. You know, certainly when he was running for governor and when he ran for Senate, he certainly talked about his business skills as a reason that people should believe that he could fix the economy, which does seem to be similar to the message he's been selling lately. But I think that's something voters really do need to maybe take a close look at, because there are things that Romney has been good at. For instance, one of his real turnarounds that is on his record is when he had to turn around Bain Consulting, which was the consulting firm that Bain Capital grew out of. And it almost failed. He got called back to Bain Consulting to deal with a huge amount of debt that the founders of that firm had put on it. And he had to talk the FDIC and banks into taking haircuts on loans, and he had to talk founders into giving back millions of dollars that they'd taken from the company. And so this is an instance where he really did have to use negotiating skills and turn around a company on the brink of failure. But as Michael was describing, that is not most of what he spent his career on at the other companies. So that is something for voters to consider.
One other thing to mention is that, you know, we do point out in the book that Romney excelled at courting investors to put millions of dollars into funds. He was a shrewd analyst of proposed ventures, and I'm reading from the book here, but he was never an expert at finding new deals. So there were some investments he brought to the table, and when he did, they often flopped, and Beth wrote about one of them. I'll let her talk to you about that.
There's this company called Lifelike, which was a doll company, and if you gave them a picture of your kid, you could get a doll that looked like your child. And, you know, apparently there are some competitor companies to this that have remained quite popular. But this, a friend of Romney's brought this deal to him, and Romney kind of brought it to his partners. And our understanding from talking to people that there was a little bit of eye rolling, like maybe it wasn't the greatest deal in the world, but they only needed to put in a couple of million, which was considered short money for Bain. And the doll company did not do well. It ended up going bankrupt. Bain lost all their money. Romney had actually remained on the board because he ended up making a personal loan and investments to the company, to try to help them keep going. But it was an example of this not necessarily being his strength to source deals.
How hard has this story been to report? I mean, I'm imagining that the sources on this are few and mostly people who made a lot of money working with Mitt Romney and therefore not necessarily very willing or conducive or eager to talk.
We started on the project for the book and the Bain chapter almost exactly a year ago. Wouldn't you say, Beth, last
July?
Yep. So it was pretty predictable that this would become a very big issue during the primaries and then the general election if he became the nominee. So we knew from the start that we wanted to talk to as many folks as possible before everyone else in the press corps started examining Bain more closely. So that was very deliberate and something that we spent a lot of time on last summer, when most people weren't really paying attention. Obviously, the Globe had covered Bain Capital and Romney for years, but we wanted to go back and really take a that much closer a look. So that was very important. I think we ended up talking to most of Romney's partners at Bain Capital, and some of them are scattered all over the world. So that was very important. And then, like I mentioned earlier, basically going through and compiling a spreadsheet of most of the deals that Romney was involved with, so you really could go through, because a lot of the deals, like I mentioned, the Italian phone company, they're just not known. Oftentimes they're referred to in a vague way without their actual name. Bain is not a public company, so it's not always easy to know what they've done. So, you know, there's plenty of roadblocks. I'm sure there's plenty of things that other journals and organizations will probably report about this deal or that deal, because like I said, every single deal is unique. There are some deals that where the people who were involved as far as workers at a plant were affected. You know, obviously those people, if they're affected negatively, they're going to be very interested and willing to talk, as they have been, you know, over the years. You know, but talking to the investors, talking to the partners and so forth, and understanding how many deals were done and what were they, in fact, that was an important part of the research.
And you're right that there is a real loyalty among Romney's partners to him, even some who've left or gone on to do other things. A lot of them still have a certain amount of gratitude because he helped them get their start. And I think almost all of them respect him as a person. They think he's smart. They thought he was good to them. But it is challenging. And in our case, because we're not doing a drive-by like some parts of the country, obviously reporters are diving into this for perhaps the first time. And we know that we've been reporting on these people for a long time, and we will be in the future. And so we had a pretty high bar for, you know, getting it right and being fair. We tried pretty hard at that.
But it's very challenging, as you point out. This is not a public company, so I'm going to assume that the kinds of data that you can actually get on any particular dealer or any particular thing are pretty limited.
Yeah, there's certain things that you can find on company. Once the companies have gone public, of course, you can find SEC records, and those are out there, whether you use 10K Wizard or Edgar. And there are various filings about some of the funds, but a lot of it is either things you have to get through sources or some documents you can get from sources.
And we, like I say, and this was very important, a year ago, we did compile this list, and then we went through, and some of the names were just completely unknown to us. And so we made it our business to basically make sure we understood what is every single deal, and then pick out the ones we wanted to spend the most time with. And there were a number on there. and again, the Italian phone company is one of the good examples, you know, that we just didn't know about, and we felt, well, let's find out. This was a very profitable deal, and so we went at it that way. So, you know, for those people who are listening who may be journalists or journalism students, you know, it's a common method. You've reported on something for a long time, as the Globe have, and then you say, okay, what do we know? And you know, let's start over. You know, we've got these stories. You know, let's not assume that everything is out there. Let's just, you know, take the time, and we both of us, I think, would agree that the Globe really said to us, you know, take the time that you need, and that, of course, is the number one essential, you know, to really look at this as in-depth as you can. And so that's what we did, you know, having the time to write a book. There were a lot of other chapters of Romney's life that also needed focus on, but this was something that probably was the most time-consuming of all the chapters, because there's so many stories within the story to tell the full story of Bain Capital over 15 years.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think you've both been doing the public and the voters a great service, and I'd like to thank you for joining us. You can read all of the Boston Globe's reporting on Bain and Romney at the website boston.com or in the book The Real Romney. People should rush out and buy a copy.